Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
An hour and a half session on an interesting subject. We'll need all our time. This is a session entitled Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy, a New Theological Movement. Hopefully we will emerge from the following discussion and questions with an enlarged concept of this term, Neo-Orthodoxy, and with clarified opinions about whether it is appropriately applied to the Mormon scene. I will briefly now introduce the panelists in the order in which I will ask them to first address you. We will ask each to take up to 10 minutes to make some kind of preliminary statement, and then when each has done that, we will have questions and responses from the panelists to each other and from you people to the panelists. Kendall White will be the first speaker. I will interject here that when each has reached the 10-minute point, I will stand or otherwise make some obvious gesture. Now, Kendall is there. Well, you'll see him in a moment standing up. Near the end of the table, professor of sociology at Washington and Lee University, author of a book very freshly off the press called Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy, A Crisis Theology. And I suspect it is this book that has provoked this panel, caused it to be formed. He will be speaking first because he has agreed to define and defend the term Neo-Orthodoxy. Our second speaker will be Janice Merrill Allred, a Provo author and mother. She recently had an article published not too long ago called Toward a Mormon Concept of Original Sin. Kendall White includes Janice Allred among recent neo-Orthodox writers with the reservation that he finds her definition of a peculiarly Mormon concept of original sin. He finds that to be a compromise between what White believes is a traditional Mormon view of human nature as good and a Protestant view of human nature as innately depraved. We will see what Janice says about that. Our third speaker will be Paul James Toscano, here next to me, Salt Lake author and lawyer, author of a book called Gospel Letters to a Mormon Missionary, which many of you will have read. Paul is an author whom Kendall identifies as of Neo-Orthodox persuasion. An author who believes in human depravity and corruptibility, a position which Kendall, if I understand him, finds heretical. And fourth, at the end of the table, we will have Kent Robeson, professor of philosophy at Utah State University, author of a number of theological articles, including Time and Omniscience in Mormon Theology. And we will look to enlightenment from Kent regarding Kendall's claim that neo-Orthodox thinkers fail to reconcile God's absoluteness with a traditional Mormon view that God is finite and evolving. Kent, I don't mean to tell you what you're going to be saying. I'm just suggesting something you might say. We will go forward now and give each panelist 10 minutes. And so, Kendall, would you please? Kendall White, author of Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy, A Crisis Theology.
As Levi indicated, what I intend to do is to explain what I mean by the use of the label of neo-orthodoxy, and then to give at least a brief indication as to why I chose it. I use the label, especially originally, not with the intent of referring to a return to any kind of Orthodox Mormon position, but in terms of its similarity to a development within Protestantism. Following World War I, with the kind of disenchantment with the rather optimistic conception of human nature that had characterized liberal Protestant developments, a theology emerged in Europe known as Protestant Neo-Orthodoxy. The Protestant Neo-Orthodox theologians articulated a position that was a return to the fundamental premises of Reformation theology, the theologies of Luther and Calvin. I don't want to overstate that too much because they certainly reformulated the traditional Reformation positions and did that primarily in light of the development of modern culture. But what they did argue was that Calvin and Luther had a basically correct conception of deity. So they affirmed the otherness and sovereignty of God, emphasizing the kind of discontinuity that obtained between the Creator and His creation. They affirmed as well the basic claim of the depravity of human nature. So the argument was that human beings were by nature sinful, corrupt. The sinfulness served essentially as a basis for, of course, the following claim with regard to salvation. Depraved, helpless, corrupt human being was certainly incapable of saving himself. The doctrine of salvation by grace and by grace only was then reaffirmed by the Neo-Orthodox theologians. This was a theological movement that after World War I enjoyed some significant development in Europe. It had little impact in the United States until the time of the Great Depression. And at that time, Reinhold Niebuhr, in his book Moral Man and Immoral Society, introduced Protestant Neo-Orthodox thought to American shores and essentially argued on the basis of his conception of human nature that came out of that especially, that these kinds of human limitations served as a more reasonable basis for understanding and dealing with social issues and social policy. Now, I use the term Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy to basically identify an affinity with this Protestant movement. I did not, in making that claim, intend to suggest that Mormon Neo-Orthodox theologians shared identical positions with the Protestant Neo-Orthodox theologians, but what I did intend to suggest is that the general thrust of that theology was in the direction of Protestant Neo-Orthodoxy. So Mormon theologians, whom I attached a label to, were essentially identified then as individuals who generally sought to enhance the absoluteness of God, or in another sense, the kind of gap or hiatus between God and humanity. And that this movement constituted as well a an acceptance of a conception of human nature as basically fallen, carnal, sinful, human nature that was, if not depraved, at least certainly moving toward a doctrine of depravity. And then, of course, consistent with that conception of human nature was a move toward a conception of salvation by grace. I think this contrast with what I would see as the fundamental impulse of Mormonism that I had identified as a synthesis of traditional Mormonism. I think traditional Mormonism necessarily has a concept of a finite or limited God, that Mormon metaphysics necessitate this. This is an issue I imagine that we'll probably be discussing later, but it seems to me that at the point at which one has assumed that matter, space, time, human intelligence all exist independently of God, that is, are uncreated, that constitutes an environment in which God acts and places limitations then on God. So God in that context then of traditional Mormon metaphysics, I think, cannot be absolute. Now, traditional Mormonism, I think, has repudiated any kind of notion of original sin and has an extremely optimistic conception of human nature that's reflected in the notion that human beings have a close affinity with God in the sense that they're not only creatures of God, that is, creations of God made in God's image, but that human beings are essentially of the same species as God. Joseph Smith's famous King Follett discourse, in which he argued that human beings were gods in embryo, I think expresses that kind of claim. It's the continuity between God and humanity that's underscored in that kind of a theology. And that's a theology, obviously, that exalts man, in quotes. That's a Joseph Smith statement, again, coming out of that King Follett discourse. Now, that optimism was then reflected, I think, in Joseph Smith's work and then in subsequent work by Brigham Young, and then was, I think, formally synthesized with theologians like B.H. Roberts, James Talmage, John Witzel, and I think a position that was essentially accepted even by those whom we would regard generally as fairly conservative Mormon theologians, people like Joseph Fielding Smith, even though I think Bruce McConkie has some neo-Orthodox propensities, Bruce McConkie nonetheless would, I think, have affirmed as well that kind of notion of human nature. Now, in the end, then, that meant that the Mormon conception of salvation was quite different from traditional Christianity. And the Mormon conception of salvation was essentially a concern not with salvation per se, but with exaltation. Salvation was virtually conceived as universal, and that universal salvation was certainly a product of divine grace. Mormons traditionally have, I think, tended to interpret that notion of grace as the basis for the physical resurrection of human beings. Following from that, then, was the problem of exaltation. And exaltation was something that was to be attained certainly by following the ordinances, sort of sacramental conception of salvation there. But I think primarily the emphasis of traditional Mormonism was on merit. that works were essential for the salvation or exaltation of humanity. And the task of becoming a god then required, of course, that grace from God. It required as well compliance with ordinances and also then the development of the kind of character that would follow through good works. Now, as I indicated then, I see the Neo-Orthodox movement as a departure from these fundamental tenets of traditional Mormonism. When I originally used the label, I was suggesting primarily the affinity with the Protestant Neo-Orthodox position. I have, and not suggesting a return, for instance, to the theology of Joseph Smith. I have, especially as a result of the work of more recent Neo-Orthodox writers, Janus and Paul, who will both probably repudiate my claims here, and also the work of recent Mormon scholarship, the kind of work that Tiager Lyon did on the development of Mormon thought through the Nauvoo period, and the work even more significantly of Thomas Alexander on the reconstruction of Mormon doctrine, come to basically see this movement as a more authentic Mormon movement than I originally suggested. That is, I think that early initial Mormon period, the period between 1830 and probably 1835, Mormon theology, I think, is not easily distinguishable from much of the Protestantism of its environment. And that period, I think, tends to have a more absolutistic conception of God. Joseph Smith's writings through that period, and I think I would share the position, at least in terms of its fundamental impulse of Neo-Orthodox writers, that the Book of Mormon at least certainly tends to have some kind of, I'll call them again Neo-Orthodox propensities. That is, there's a great deal in the Book of Mormon that talks about corrupt human nature, fallen human nature, and the necessity of grace as a basis for coming to terms with that human nature. So my concluding sentence here. My point then would be that I see in now the use of the label of Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy not just a parallel with the Protestant movement, but a more authentic kind of return to the earliest position of Joseph Smith. I think, however, that's not a return to the legacy that Joseph Smith left for Mormonism. That legacy, I think, is encoded essentially in traditional Mormon thought.
In his forthcoming book, Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy, A Crisis Theology, O. Kendall White maintains that as a response to a crisis in today's social environment, a group of Mormon theologians has elaborated a theology similar to Protestant Neo-Orthodoxy. And he calls this movement Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy, as he has stated. While White does make it clear that he has adopted this term to signify similarities between Protestant Neo-Orthodoxy and this Mormon theology, I think that if his terminology is adopted by Mormon thinkers, it will lead to confusion rather than enlightenment and an emphasis on an issue inimical to the development of a vital theology. The term is likely to be confusing to Mormons unfamiliar with White's thesis. It seems probable that they will either assume it refers to theologians who have returned to an earlier orthodoxy, and he has stated here that perhaps that is true, or to thinkers who have established a new orthodoxy. But neither assumption, of course, would be totally correct. But more important would be a focusing of Mormon thought on the question of orthodoxy. Joseph Smith resisted the idea of establishing a Mormon creed. It felt so good to him to be unfettered by articles of faith in his search for truth. Mormon belief in continuous revelation and free agency also count against a demand for orthodoxy in Mormon theology. I'm not advocating a theology in which no attempt is made to understand or explicate the ideas of authorities. Indeed, I think that for Mormon theology, the scriptures and words of the prophets ought to furnish the foundation concepts. But the thrust of theological thought ought to be towards discovering and elucidating religious truth rather than establishing an orthodoxy. Too often the idea of orthodoxy is used to coerce thought rather than enlighten and to stop thinking rather than encourage it. Fred Voros proposed the labels humanistic Mormons and redemptive Mormons to distinguish the two groups that White calls traditional Mormons and neo-orthodox Mormons. I think these terms are more useful because they describe the ideas of the two groups and do not cast the issue between them onto the question of orthodoxy. White advances two main criticisms against redemptive Mormon theologians. One is that they depart from traditional Mormon ideas on the nature of God, the nature of man, and the process of salvation. His attempt to establish what is traditional Mormon thought on these issues is selective rather than exhaustive, and he seems to have simply chosen the ideas that most Mormon intellectuals find palatable to their intellectualism. His appeal in this attempt is, of course, to authority. He implies that we should reject the arguments of these theologians because they are not supported by the authority of tradition. I think theologians should not depend on the authority of tradition for their ideas. It may well be that we as Mormons have misconstrued some of our scriptures, that we've used faulty reasoning, developed some of our concepts, that we have relied on false philosophical notions, or that we have emphasized certain aspects of our theology at the expense of equally important concepts, and we need serious Mormon thinkers to point us in new directions. To further support his contention that redemptive Mormonism is non-traditional, White points out similarities between Protestant neo-orthodoxy and Mormon redemptive theology. That Protestants and Mormons should have similar ideas on the basic redemptive gospel is not surprising, since it is found in the New Testament as well as the Book of Mormon Doctrine and Covenants. And I think it is arrogant of us Mormons to suppose that we cannot learn anything from the rest of Christianity about sin, faith, repentance, and the need for a Redeemer. White is very concerned that Mormons maintain their distinctness from Protestants. Joseph Smith said that it is our having the Holy Ghost and revelation that distinguishes us from them. White wants us to maintain our distinctness through our ideas. If we do that, then we are truly nothing but another Protestant sect, for that is how they distinguish themselves from one another. On the other hand, some of the ideas of humanistic Mormons seem rather close to those of liberal Protestants, that we do not need a Savior, that we are not in a predicament from which we need salvation, that the importance of Jesus is found in his exemplary moral life. The second main argument White has against redemptive Mormonism is that it is a crisis theology. This criticism is subtle, since it is cast in the intellectual framework of analysis of the theology through the methods of the sociology of religion. The sociology of religion examines religious beliefs within their social and cultural contexts. White describes cultural crises and argues that the feelings of contingency, powerlessness, non-rationality, and authoritarianism experienced by neo-Orthodox theologians during a crisis situation are projected onto human nature itself and become the foundation of the basic doctrines of divine sovereignty, human depravity, and salvation by grace. The implication is that the doctrines believed in during times of crisis have no objective truth. But if this is true of religious ideas emerging from crises, then it is also true of the humanistic theologies which are the product of good times. However, an idea is not true or untrue because of how it was come upon. We must test its truth in other ways, through reason, experiment, authority, or intuition. Indeed, we need a critical situation to test the strength of anything. If all the students get hundreds on the test, it probably doesn't mean that all the students are equally smart or prepared, but that the test was too easy. The scriptures agree with the sociology of religion's thesis that in times of crisis, men recognize their own weakness and turn to God, while they tend to forget him and even disbelieve him in good times. The conclusion of the scriptures, however, is that man is foolish and sinful, not that God is simply a projection of his need for something greater than himself. White also finds fault with redemptive theologians for non-rationalism or for not having reason as their highest value. I might accuse White of hypocrisy here. Can a disciple of the sociology of religion seriously put forward reason as an intellectual value? Doesn't his discipline maintain that ideas are environmentally determined? It's not surprising that theologians point out the limitations of reason, since theology is ultimately based on the revelation of God to man. And theologians are not alone in pointing out the limits of reason. For philosophers, logicians, psychologists, sociologists, artists, and practical people have all had something to say about the limitations of reason. Reason, nevertheless, is an important tool in theology for examining the relationships between ideas, for organizing thought, for drawing valid conclusions. Theology, indeed, might be characterized as reasoning about or interpreting ideas given by revelation. White is also afraid that if Mormonism adopts the ideas of its redemptive theologians, it might decrease its commitment to education. He asserts that Mormons have traditionally believed that the gospel embraces all truth, and thus we have a religious duty to pursue secular learning. Redemptive theologians have argued that the gospel does not include all truth because the gospel is found in scriptures and all truth is not. The gospel is simply the good news that we can be saved from our sins through faith in Jesus Christ, repentance, baptism, the gift of the Holy Ghost, and enduring to the end. But to say that the gospel does not include all truth is not to say that there is no value in learning all truth, or even to limit the scope of theology to the gospel. White says that knowing all truth is essential to our exaltation, so that our secular education takes us further along the road to exaltation. Such an elitism is far removed from the teachings of the scriptures. White seems to feel that if Mormons come to believe that secular learning will not increase their chances for exaltation, they will lose their commitment to it. I think that Mormons are much more pragmatic than that and much more interested in success in this world. There are many good reasons for pursuing secular learning. If Mormonism ever should abandon its liberal educational ideas, it is very unlikely to be due to the ideas of redemptive theology. It's much more likely to be the fault of Mormon intellectuals who lose their faith and use their learning to attack the faith of others. I do not have time here to defend in detail the three concepts of redemptive theology that White takes issue with. I would like to say a little about the nature of man and the nature of God. White claims that traditional Mormonism holds that man is innately good, and that this concept rests on Joseph Smith's teaching that the intelligence of man is coeternal with God. He gets very upset by the suggestion of some redemptive theologians that man's primal intelligence may have been an undifferentiated mass, or that it may have been part of God's intelligence. But to be uncreated is not necessarily to be essentially good, and it seems to me that a stronger case might be made for man's innate goodness if he were created by God than if he were an eternal individual ego totally separate from God. What White is really afraid of is that man might somehow be contingent upon God and have an obligation to worship him. On the issue of depravity, White claims that traditional Mormonism never teaches that man is in a condition of sin, but that sin is always a specific act. If this is true, then it is an indictment of Mormonism, for Jesus taught that what is in the heart is more important than outward behavior, and keeping the law was for him an outright sin if the inner nature was corrupt. Furthermore, this concept of sin cannot explain why, if man is innately good, that he sins. What is in his nature or condition accounts for it. White accuses redemptive theologians of favoring an absolutist conception of God. He acknowledges that they accept the traditional Mormon notions about God being in space and time and limited by law and man's agency, but he claims that they have misunderstood the implications of this metaphysics for the language of absolutism. What White fails to recognize is that the language of absolutism is in many ways identical with scriptural terminology. The scriptures call God infinite, yet they never describe the absolutist God, who is nothing more than a creation of human reason. Mormon theologians ought to be knowledgeable in traditional Christian theology so that they can disclaim absolutist notions of God, yet I see no reason to give up the scriptural language describing God to the absolutists. God in Mormon metaphysics is in some respects finite. So is man. Humanistic Mormon theologians have failed to point out how man's finitude is different from God's. They fail to give adequate reasons as to why man should worship God, as to why man needs God. Human reason has given us the absolutist God, a God outside of space and time who can have no relations with mankind. Revelation has given us the real God who became man, who suffers with us and for us, and who is inextricably involved in human affairs. Mormon theologians cannot ignore the scriptures and revelation, for they tell us about God and give us the gospel that enables us to become like him. White and other humanistic Mormon thinkers have embraced Mormon metaphysics, but rejected or ignored the scriptures, especially the Book of Mormon. Now, if some of Joseph Smith's ideas, especially those given in the King Fall Discourse, appeal to these thinkers because of their philosophical power, that's fine, but why don't they then support them philosophically? Why appeal to the authority of Joseph Smith to support the ideas of Mormon metaphysics while rejecting or ignoring the scriptures and other aspects of his thought? What Wright is trying to do in his book is discredit Mormon redemptive theology by labeling it non-rational, authoritarian, non-traditional, and Protestant or non-Mormon. What I have tried to show is that White has not shown this, and further, that he is himself guilty of unsound reasoning, appealing to authority, and ignoring important Mormon concepts.
First of all, let me say that I admire anybody who writes a book because you put a little piece of it of yourself in it and then send it out there and then people do this to you. and that I have, I didn't know what Kendall looked like, and you can't judge a book by its cover, but I think you can say a lot about a person by how they look. Very amiable chap. And I remember when Gene Sessions reviewed my book in Dialogue, he said that it was just pap, you know, it was a little Happy Daddy gift book. And then I didn't think it was that. I neither did anybody else. No one bought it. And it has been relegated to the devotional section, and that's death. But somebody found in it theology, which I was happy to hear. Somebody read it. So there we are. I intend to say things and sometimes be a little rough, but it's all in the spirit of keeping the Sunstone Symposium from lapsing into coma. The first thing I'd like to point out is that I keep asking myself, why is it that Kendall has bothered to hunt this thing out, this theological animal, and give it a name? And I think the reason is that I think down in, he might be trying to just do this so that he can kill it. And I think the reason why he wants to kill, how is he going to do this? How is he going to kill this theological beast? And I think he's going to stereotype it to death. And that's the impression I get from reading his book. The debate that we're involved in goes way back and has been debated by much greater luminaries than any of us will ever be. It goes back to what the intellectuals have, and the Renaissance called the Dark Ages. There was a British monk by the name of Pelagius, who was a thin, ascetic, virtuous, and probably quite dour individual, who had always managed to obey the rules and thought everybody else could do it too, if they were properly educated and put their minds to it, after all. And then there was the other monk, Augustine, who was quite different altogether. He was a little indulgent and probably overbearing and overweight, and he did not think men could obey the rules, and or women either, but they talked in terms of men, because he tried and failed. Both men, I believe, generalized from their religious experience and came up with quite different notions about the gospel. Pelagius thought Christ's principal role, I believe, was really as an example. When you get through all of the words, I think that's probably what it is. Christ's purpose was to show us what we could do if we really tried. Augustine thought Christ's principal role was as a vicarious sacrifice, to take upon himself our sins and limitations and die for them as if he were as sinful as we, so that we could live as if we were as righteous as he. The imputation of Christ's righteousness to man and the imputation of man's sin to Christ. The view of Augustine on the question of salvation was lumped together with all of his other views on theology and was served up as Orthodox religion. Well, the debate today is about the old grace works dichotomy, what we call redemptive Mormonism versus humanistic Mormonism, but what Kendall calls neo-orthodoxy versus traditional Mormonism. But as it turns out, it isn't really traditional, it's just it's more popular. It's the Mormonism reflected, I think, in popular culture, what people have come to like. It's like a cafeteria when you take what you like. And there's nothing wrong with that. This is a free country in most places. In this room. Well, I don't think on our side we are really neo-Orthodox, and I don't think on Kendall's side and Ken's side they're really traditional. I don't think they buy the golden plate story and the angel story and Mormon polygamy and all of the other traditional things. And we don't buy all the absolutist stuff and the omni stuff. I mean, I use the word omniscient, omnipresent in my book, but all I mean by that is that God's finitude is different from our finitude, that he can pass through walls and answer everybody's prayers and do stuff that we can't do, and I don't know how, but and he doesn't die, and he doesn't have gallstones and things like that, and we all get these things from time or worse. And that I'm just trying to express a difference between the qualitative life of God as a spiritual and eternal being, whatever eternal means, as opposed to temporal. And that's all I mean. I am not buying into the rigid categories of the classical philosophers who seized Christianity in the early days and turned it into a religion that is of doubtful help. My next point goes to the question of the fact that Kendall's thesis is that neo-orthodoxy is a rainy day religion. It's the kind of thing you believe in when things are tough. But when the sky clears, you go out there and you think well of yourself and achieve. Well, this sounds good, but he never really shows this in his book. I would have supposed that he would have perhaps given us examples, like, for example, like maybe during World War I or World War II or the Vietnam War, swarms of people became gracers, and how in the good times, the 20s and the Eisenhower years, people returned to the normalcy of Pelagianism. But he doesn't do this, and I don't really think he could do it, because I don't think the evidence is that neat. And the reason why this is so is because I think he misunderstands the reason why grace is a movement and always has been in Christianity. And that is because it is a reaction to legalism. Christianity itself was a reaction to the legalism of the Jews. And Luther was a reaction to the frozen categories of Catholicism. And I think that what he doesn't further understand is that the legalism arises from Pelagianism, from the idea that man has the power in himself to save himself if he will just live the rules, you see. Well, what that does is the legislators go berserk. They run to the halls of the legislature and they start making rules about every department of life. And what happens is that it reduces the world to two camps, those who achieve and those who don't, within this regimen of rules. Those who achieve generally become arrogant about their accomplishments, and they start getting excited about the possibility of human perfection, and so they become utopianists, and they start generating schemes to get everyone else to be perfect, and then they finally realize that people can be such backsliders. That's a plug for Levi's book. So they start using manipulation and then soft coercion and finally full-blown force, and they become Leninists or Hitlerists or something. Totalitarianism, you understand, is the temptation of all those who believe in unlimited human potential. This was always the burden of the speeches of Hitler at those Nuremberg rallies. And in the other camp are those who don't achieve and therefore despair and in their desperation are tempted to believe the achievers, you see, when they say that all the non-achievers need to do to achieve is to be better educated and have a better environment and get better leaders like the achievers. So what Pelagianism leads to, or humanistic Mormonism leads to, is a syndrome of arrogance and despair. My point in my book is that grace is not so bad, because it accepts rational human limits on human potential. No, we can't build a thousand-year Reich, no matter what you say. The grace concept is not a concept of irresistible grace. I don't believe in that, predestination, predetermination, determination. In my view, the problem in Mormonism with this idea of grace is that we confuse the secular idea of human improvement with the sacral idea of salvation. I believe in human improvement. If you want to go learn French, go learn the rules, do the thing, you'll learn French. If you want to improve yourself and make money, go do it. But if you're trying to make yourself holy, it is not possible to resurrect yourself, to endow yourself with all the knowledge that all the panelists have. You can't raise the dead and heal the sick on our own. And all I'm saying is that we need the grace of God, the powers of heaven, to come into the earth to empower man to do things that are beyond human possibility. And that's grace. And salvation is in the camp of those things. And this is great stuff, because I'm not okay, you're not okay. And that's a great relief, I believe, for all those people who are not doing their home teaching or writing in their journal or doing the list of things that is the answer to all of our problems and the answer to none of our problems. It's a relief to find out that those things don't matter, that you do not have to do all of these things and build a utopia. Well, my final point is just a series of them very briefly. I am not Orthodox, and I'm certainly not neo-Orthodox, which sounds like some kind of a bug killer. I certainly do not believe in an absolute God of rational philosophy, and I'm not going to. Absolute gods don't bleed to death. It's a contradiction. I prefer, and I find that distasteful. A totally other God is distasteful to me. Someone who stands out of suffering and out of the world and looks at all the kids suffering and just is up there. I find that very distasteful. I prefer to believe in a God, in the bleeding, dying God, rather than in the one whose most highly touted attribute is his ability to evade detection, weasel out of responsibility, and charm the hell out of philosophy majors. Philosophy majors. That wasn't you. I suppose you're beyond that. I can see Ken all getting all geared up. Because this, he says, now, I couldn't get Janice, but I can get this guy. He's got my book. Well, this is my opening salvo to you guys. You've written a book about... you've written a book, but we don't know where you stand on religion. You've basically said what we are, but you haven't said what you are. And you've taken kind of the high and foggy ground of obfuscation. What I would like to have you do is come out, and tell us what you believe so that the debate will be on an equal footing.
After that. that charming and amusing discourse by Paul, I feel at something of a disadvantage in speaking to you this morning. I have read works by all of these people, and I'd like to start with words of commendation. I must say that I've learned from each of them and found them all to be stimulating and interesting. I have some reservations about this and that. There are things that I would have done differently, things that I would have said differently, and yet I think such an exchange in print has been extremely valuable, and the exchange today might even prove to be at least interesting. I'd like to start with Kendall's work, which I think is a very important piece of work, and which I commend to you. I don't know what to make of the title, Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy. I've suggested previously to Kendall that I'm a little uncomfortable with the attempt to compare it with Protestantism and Protestant, what is called Protestant Neo-Orthodoxy, because there are significant differences.
This is the end of side one.
There is something interesting here, that there was roughly a Catholic-Protestant position in philosophy and theology that was characteristic of Catholicism and Protestantism for a very, very long time, and that there are some writers in Mormonism that are more comfortable with that Catholic-Protestant position than the position that was articulated by Joseph Smith during the latter part of his life. And so I would agree with Kendall, after about 1835 up to 1844, and especially in the King Follett Discourse, it was well understood by Brigham Young and articulated by him, espoused by him. It was well understood by the Pratt brothers, Parley P. Pratt's discourses, I think reflect that very well. It was well understood by B.H. Roberts, even by James E. Talmage and John A. Widsoe to a very great extent. But the surprising thing to me is that there have been a group of writers more recently that have developed positions that hark back to some things that can be found in the Book of Mormon, positions that Joseph Smith himself espoused before 1835. But they sound an awful lot like Protestantism, Catholicism. And I appreciate very much Ken White's attempt to suggest that there is a difference between these positions and articulate that difference. I think he does so well. Now, I'm not a sociologist, and so you wouldn't be surprised if I don't take the sociology of religion very seriously. Now, my wife is a sociologist, and so she will probably be angry with me when I say this. But, you know, it seems to me that rather than worrying about movements and crises at different times, in theology it's a whole lot more interesting to look at individuals and what the immediate influences on those individuals are and why they come up with the views that they come up with. And yet, in the book, Ken White has talked about a number of interesting things that have been going on in the church roughly since 1933. He talks about the an anti-intellectual tendency in the church, and I think it's clearly there. I ascribe it to a very great extent to the influence of J. Reuben Clark and the legacy that he left within the church. He talks about a kind of anti-communist movement in the church, and it's still around, and it's awfully hard for an awful lot of Mormons
to recognize that communists are people too, and that people join communist parties for a whole wide variety of reasons that have nothing to do with the ideology. It was a surprise to me to discover that the first time I spent a year in the communist country of Poland, but I discovered I had friends who were members of the Communist Party who didn't care anything about the ideology. And so it's interesting to look at the Mormon reaction to communism. He also talks about the evolution issue. But the three primary issues he discusses are the sovereignty of God, the depravity of man, and salvation by grace rather than merit. And those are the things that characterize what he calls neo-orthodoxy. Now, I'm inclined to think that some of these other things ought to be included as well. I'm also inclined to think that there probably hasn't been one big crisis, at least cultural or social crisis in the context of the sociology of religion, that if there's been a crisis, it's been a whole series of small crises for Paul and Janus and others, as they have tried to deal with other pointy-headed intellectuals that come and tell them what theology is. But the crises have been ongoing roughly since 1933. I'm not sure that there is a big movement, but one can characterize positions taken by some of the important authorities of the LDS Church and distinguish it from positions taken by B.H. Roberts and Parley Pratt and even Joseph Smith. Now, after I've said all of that, what I'd like to do is to point to a problem. The problem I'd like to point to is the problem of human freedom. Underlying the issues that I see these people currently discussing is the problem of freedom. Do we have any of it? Is it important to us? Do we want to make sense of free agency or freedom or both? And for my money, I can tell you that I find freedom terribly, terribly important. I want to make very good sense of it, and so I think it's important to have a metaphysical position on the basis of which you can both explain and defend freedom. And I tried to present that in some small measure in my Sunstone article in 82, The Foundations of Freedom in Mormon Theology. In fact, I think that Mormons, or those who espouse the legacy that I've talked about from Joseph Smith on, have a more firm and deeply entrenched concept of freedom than any other theology that I know of. Not only is it a theology that can be molded into a brilliant theodicy to solve the problem of evil, but it's a theology that yields itself to the explication of a concept of freedom that is terribly, terribly important and applicable to the very issues that we've been talking about. Now, when Janus, in her article on original sin, talks about the inevitability of sin for all of us, that begins to worry me as I think about freedom. Is it possible for anybody to have been free to be free? Is it possible for any of us to avoid sin? Would it be possible for one person besides Christ to have avoided sin? Now, I don't want to foreclose those possibilities. Similarly, when Paul, in his book, and I'd like to say a couple of remarks about his book, talks about depravity. That depravity worries me because it may threaten the concept of freedom. Now, what I would like to say is that there is some marvelous material in this book. This little book, Gospel Letters to a Missionary. For example, the chapter on authority, freedom, and obedience, and the emphasis on section 121 of the Doctrine and Covenants is, I think, just marvelous. It happens to be my favorite section of Scripture, Paul. And I like it very, very much. What worries me in Paul's book is a previous chapter, The Fallen Nature of Man, in which he talks about depravity. Now, one of the things that worries me is that he has used a state word, a word depravity describing a state, for a word that I think he wants to be a capability word. So he doesn't want, he does apply depravity to children, but he does so primarily because they are susceptible of becoming depraved. And then he wants to apply depravity to everybody else. It seems to me that a word like corruptibility is better because it hints of this capability of becoming corrupt rather than depravity itself. Or susceptible to becoming depraved would have been better than depravity itself. This is a small point, however. The point that really worries me here is whether, when one explores and pushes his idea, whether it really is possible to make sense of the free individual agency and freedom of man. Whether it is possible for one not to sin. Now, I looked at another article, one by Don Olson, in I think it's the 84, let's see, it's volume 9, could be 85, issue of Sunstone number 2, on the concept of grace. And in that concept of grace, one of the things that he says there, and it relates to this issue of freedom, tell me when I'm finished, Levi, is that we are all foreordained to do the things that we do, all the things that we do. Well, it seems to me that if you take that idea of foreordination too seriously, you end up without a concept of freedom. And that's discussed somewhat in that previous article on foundations of freedom in Mormon theology that I mentioned. But it's the concept of freedom in discussing this article on grace, in discussing Paul's book, in discussing Janus's article on original sin that worries me. Was it possible for Jesus to not have sinned? Did he have the freedom not to sin? And if it was possible for him, is it possible for anyone else? Is it possible for us ever not to sin? You know, it's clear, I think, I don't know very many people who haven't sinned, but I know some very good people who in some aspects of their life don't sin. And I don't think that they're depraved in those aspects of their lives. In fact, it isn't beyond the realm of my possibility that there might even be some people around who haven't sinned at all. Now, Janus, in her article, talks about the fact that people sin primarily because of the very complexities of moral situations, the fact that there are very, very difficult countervailing influences on many of the moral situations we encounter. That's clear. I think there were for even Jesus. But sin occurs, I would suggest, only when sorting through all of those complexities, you make the wrong choice. And hopefully Jesus did never make the wrong choice. So the mere fact that we suffer very complex moral situations doesn't ensure that we must sin. Well, as a result of these kinds of considerations, I must say I like Ken White's book. I think he's right that there is such a thing as some tendency in Mormon theology, whether you call it neo-orthodox or something else, that worries me. And one of the main reasons it worries me is that there may not be a viable concept of free agency and freedom if one pursues those concepts. And that's why I worry about them. I recoil against the idea that sin must be inevitable and that we are innately, inherently depraved, and always so. And that's why I like Ken White's book and recommend it to you. Thank you.
Now, I think given the bruising they've given one another, we should have the panel respond to one another. Would it be appropriate, perhaps, for Kendall, since you've taken some good blows, to return some? Do you want to make a rebuttal, Kendall?
Yeah, I would like to make some general comments. Can you hear me? If I stay seated,
pull it up close.
They might not be able to see me if I'm standing up there. But I'll do that.
Okay, but I'm going to stand with him.
See, I told you. In fact, I actually feel like a little bit like one of my mentors, Waldemar P. Reed, who on a similar occasion had suggested that he felt a bit like a lion in a den of Daniels. What I'm going to do initially here is just respond, I think, to what I detect as some of the general positions shared, I think, maybe even by all three of the panelists. One of those would be the assumptions of the kind of claims that I'm making from the perspective of the sociology of religion. Now, part of the issue here is a question of whether looking at the kind of social conditions that I think, if they didn't literally give birth to such ideas as the neo-Orthodox ideas, they certainly provided the sort of social climate in which such ideas would be appealing and attractive to individuals. I'm not trying to make a claim for a kind of rigid sociological determinism to suggest that these ideas in and of themselves simply originate out of that condition and they're simple projections of the condition. I think Janice made a point that's an important one, and I kind of hope that the book in the early chapters there would have address the issue that she's suggesting. It isn't addressed extensively. There's no question of that. There's a sort of disclaimer in there that I'm making right now about what kind of claims can be made from the sociology of religion. But there's also, I think, or at least I'd hope, recognition that the experience of some kind of personal or social crisis does not negate in any sense any kind of truth claims that might be made. To, in fact, invoke one of the primary Protestant neo-Orthodox theologians, Karl Barth, who used to argue that he loved to preach primarily to prisoners. They were individuals who knew about their captivity. They couldn't hide it. It was impressed on them constantly. You and I, from Bart's position, are prisoners in every bit as much a sense, and I think Janice and Paul would probably share that. And they'd add to it that Kent and I tend to be unaware of the bars that are around us. So I'm not, in making that suggestion, that there's an intimate relationship between personal experience and maybe social and cultural crises in generating appeal of these ideas and in enhancing their elaboration, making any suggestion that they're either true or false. In fact, I didn't perceive the book as addressing the question of the truth claims of either traditional Mormonism or neo-Orthodox Mormonism. Paul had raised the question of getting our positions out here on the table so the debate could go on in those terms. My own position is not one of identifying with traditional Mormon theology, even if the book gives a sense that I have some profound sympathies for that. My own position is outside of Mormonism. I see this as a description and analysis of what I saw as two major trends in Mormon development. I would characterize myself as an agnostic humanist and not in any kind of clear theological position in terms of either of these. I don't want by the book to discourage debate over those issues regarding traditional Mormonism and the neo-orthodoxy, and perhaps both Janice and Paul's points are well taken there, that maybe I should have used a label other than one that entails orthodoxy. I chose the label, as I indicated earlier, because of the affinity with the Protestant movement, and then also felt even more comfortable with it now because I think it reflects an authentic early Mormon position. So I'm not defining you as heretics. I think I originally did back in the earliest work on Mormon neo-orthodoxy, but I don't feel that way now. I see an authentic tradition there, one that ought to be in dialogue with the popular Mormonism, humanistic Mormonism. And so I really do welcome the kind of work that both Paul and Janice and Olson and Voros have produced recently. I think that there are some serious implications to the redemptive Mormonism, if we want to shift labels for the moment, where the emphasis is so much on the experience of grace, that I think there are a number of kinds of things that characterize Mormonism through the better part of its history that are threatened by this. I indicate in the book that I think the Mormon conception of revelation, which was consistent or congruent with Mormon efforts at education and the affirmation of the world that Mormonism had displayed, is seriously threatened by a theology that tends to widen the gap again between God and humanity. I think traditional Mormon conceptions of revelation are quite different from the kinds that exist, for instance, in much of Protestantism, Catholicism, and even in other world religions. In a lot of those cases, revelation is a way of actually baffling the intellect, of demonstrating the frailties of human beings and the inability of human beings to know
as God knows. Mormon revelation, I think, was never characterized by that impulse. Joseph Smith went out into that grove and comes back with something that he can intellectually understand. He comes back with a conception of God that he can describe. In fact, what Mormon revelation does is make matters more intelligible for him. That's his first reason for going out into that grove in the first place, to get answers to those questions. Not to discover that those are questions that have no answers, or to discover that human beings cannot know those kinds of things. Mormon revelation, I think, has been very commonsensical. It's often been quite contradictory. But at the same time, it's been fundamentally rational in nature. And that's consistent and congruent with Mormon metaphysics. Traditional Mormonism, I think, expanded and developed some of those kinds of basic impulses. My fear is that one of the implications that the redemptive Mormonism or neo-orthodox Mormonism could develop is this kind of notion of revelation that does end up really denying human potentiality and possibility. I think there are dangers to some of our assumptions there, but I think Paul pointed those out with a kind of suggestion that some of us might be leaning toward Nuremberg and Hitler. I think I identified you with somewhat more pleasing characters, Karl Barth, Emil Brunner, and in fact, let's say the Reinhold Niebuhr, whom I would regard as the greatest theologian America ever produced, and certainly shows awfully important positive implications that follow from new orthodox positions.
Left detach. You said just stand and speak. See if that will pull out. Next two. Do it. Paul, are you next?
I think I will say something.
All right.
Very briefly, first of all, I think any man who can, in this kind of a context, having written the book, any man who in this context of this debate, who has written the book that Kendall has and can come up to this podium and, in a sense, confess the weaknesses of his own work, as he has done, deserves tremendous admiration, because it shows that that person is not closed within the categories of his own research. And that's so rare among any scholar. And I think that if you want to show Kendall your admiration, go out and buy his book with your own money. As for myself, I'd just like to say a point about, and the fact that he doesn't think I'm a heretic makes me feel much better. And I wish that Marky Peterson were alive so he could tell him that. As with respect to freedom, which Kent, I want you to know that my whole interest in redemptive Mormonism is an outgrowth of my very great concern about freedom. And I see the redemption of Christ, the grace of Christ, as a principal metaphysic of freedom. That's why I buy into it. Love and grace are the principal pillars of my personal theology. And I believe that the grace of Christ is the thing that sets us free from determinism. I don't know whether we're free or determined, and no one knows that. But I do know that the atonement of Christ creates a metaphysic of freedom. It allows me then to choose among options which maybe I didn't have, and in a real metaphysical sense, it might give me the power of heaven to choose something holy that is beyond my reach. So I believe in freedom. Now, there is philosophical, I think what happens is that we want so much as rational beings to have a metaphysic of freedom that sometimes we don't realize that a metaphysic of freedom can, in effect, work against real freedom in the real world. There are a number of different kinds of freedom. Moral freedom, the freedom to only obey the rules, that is not freedom. Political freedom, the freedom to elect your governors, that isn't real freedom. The only real freedom is personal individual freedom, and that is a body of rights and powers which resides inalienably in every single human being, which is sacrosanct and cannot be abridged or diminished by any other human being. And Christ's teachings about spiritual gifts and each human being being a temple and each being human being having been saved and bearing the image of God and therefore is sacrosanct because they bear this grace, and even if they don't, in the Christian sense, every person that's born in the world has this. This is a doctrine and teaching of freedom. And that in most places in the world where freedom is taken away from people, the first exercise of the takers is to break down a theology of freedom among those people and to build up in its place a regimen of rules. As soon as people begin to believe that they are saved by an exoskeleton that keeps the chaos from exploding into the void, then the effort is going to be to build this rigid exoskeleton of rules. But when you believe that the grace of God is reposed in you and in little children and in anybody that's born into the world, man, woman, whatever, and that the purpose of the gospel is to develop this grace in you, that the image of God grows in you, then you don't believe in an exoskeleton, a great crustacean with an oozy inside and a hard outside. What you believe in is that the Spirit of God is within you, that makes you holy, that makes you sacrosanct, and then you are free. And that is the metaphysic in which I believe. And sometimes I think that there is, we value the freedom, a conceptual freedom, to the extent that we deny the real freedom that must exist in the real world and in our heart. So I am not an anti-intellectual. I am not Ernest Wilkinson, and he is not in our camp. And you can name a lot of other people. I mean, somebody said that Ernest Wilkinson was a neo-Orthodox theologian. This is a preposterous statement. I knew Ernest Wilkinson, and he was not.
I didn't say that.
Well, no, you did not. But somebody came up to me and said, well, Ernest Wilkinson is in your camp. Well, good heavens, I knew Ernest, and he was a legalist of the first order. And it is legalism, which was the, it is being anti-legalistic that was the caused Christ to be crucified. They hauled him out and nailed him to a piece of wood because he said that you cannot be saved by a religious, devoted commitment to a series of prescriptions and rules, but that every person is free to see God, to choose God, and that is at the heart of the redemptive Mormon movement. And you know why it is? Because we live now in a growing legalistic Mormon environment where every day we are being told what to do in every department of our lives. And the answer to that is not rebellion. The scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, all that they say and do, that observe and do, but do not after their works. What we have to do in response to this legalism is to obtain the grace of Christ and the metaphysic of grace and throw that up in the face of the present order and say that we are free because God has made us free.
I'd like to say, too, that I appreciate Kendall's disclaimers, but I think that nevertheless, as he pointed out in the remainder of his rebuttal, that the thrust of his book is to disagree with or to put down redemptive ideas. And the reason he does that is because he brands them, I think, anti-intellectual, non-reasonable, and this sort of thing. And I think that he does not show that. And I think also that we need to realize that we have to have a balance between certain values. Now, Kant has mentioned his commitment to the idea of free agency, and Paul has said that we also are committed to that, and I also am. But I think that here again, as a theologian, we have to say we don't absolutize our commitment to freedom. We don't say that freedom is the most important value. We have to look at other things, like, for instance, Kendall points out that some neo-Orthodox theologians have had difficulty in reconciling foreknowledge of God with human freedom. That's a problem. And if you accept both of those ideas, you have to do that. And so, just to say that we have to choose freedom above all other values, I think, is not right, because choosing freedom is just a matter of choice there, I think. Reason will not give it to us. And also, answering Kant, I think that he has said that the idea of depravity is inconsistent with human freedom. Freedom is always within limits. We don't always have the choice to choose anything. And as Paul has pointed out, this doesn't mean that man cannot choose good. Man has the choice of choosing God and other kinds of choices that are human. But to say that man must inevitably sin is only to say that he is circumscribed by his nature. Now, I think even a humanist philosopher would say man cannot choose anything. He has to choose the things that are possible within the abilities of man. And so freedom is not absolute in this sense. Going on to the concept of innate goodness or depravity, it's because I believe in freedom that I think that it is essentially meaningless to say that man is either innately good or innately evil. I think that my position is that he is in a condition. The human condition implies, or the human condition makes it impossible for him to avoid sin. This does not say that he is innately evil and doesn't say that he is innately good. He has the freedom to work out what he is going to end up being, and this freedom is given to him through the grace of God, as Paul pointed out. Again, Kant, I think, tried to label redemptive theology as anti-communist, anti-intellectual, and this sort of thing, anti-evolution. And I think that, sure, you can find statements by people who have espoused redemptive theology to show that these people have held these kind of ideas, but I don't think there is any necessary connection between it. And to bring up these outside issues on the question of the truth or non-truth of redemptive theology, I think, is extraneous and beside the point. Of course, if you're just taking the point of view of a historian or somebody who is interested in how these things go, that's fine. But I think that, at least in Kendall's book and in the issue, it sort of gets mixed up, the historical approach, you know, the intellectual approach. We just want to know what these people think, and isn't it interesting that this, all of these ideas, that this baggage goes along with it. But I think it doesn't have to, and bringing it in is, in a sense, unfair, because you get labeled with things that you aren't really. And it is Kendall that mentions Ernest Wilkinson.
Not as a neo-orthodox theologian.
But as somebody who's anti-communist, so why bring him in at all? I didn't understand
may
that.
May I actually respond to that? What I was doing in the discussion that you're alluding to is talking really about an earlier generation of Mormon neo-orthodox writers, as you know, and was talking about the social context out of which the movement was growing. And part of that was to assess a kind of social ethic that might follow then from theological positions. And I think that whether I was correct or incorrect, the basic argument that I was making is that the earlier generation of Mormon Neo-Orthodox theologians, including people like Hiram Andrus, David Yorn, Glenn Pearson, and so on, had out of that a political agenda that followed from the cultural crisis that we were talking about, and that only Hugh Nibley of those theologians seemed to see those ideas as generating for him a social ethic that would be more like the kind of thing that somebody like Reinhold Niebuhr had done. Now, I didn't in the discussion of you newer generation of neo-orthodox theologians or redemptive theologians do anything with your social ethics. You either hadn't written on the subject for me, and I'd not met any of you until now.
Well, I clearly declare myself for Gary Hart.
Vote for him.
Okay. Janice, why don't you complete, and let's leave Kent a few minutes to make a response.
Okay, that's fine. I appreciate that disclaimer, too. But I do think that the very presence of those kinds of things in there tend to obscure the issue, at least for us, rather than to enlighten. And just let me conclude by saying that on the question of reason, personally, I'm quite a reasonable person, and I've learned a lot about reason, and I use it a lot, but I don't think this, again, is an ultimate value. Reason cannot supply us with our basic premises, and I think that Kendall does sort of idolize reason, again, and puts it as the ultimate value. And I tried to point out that it was reason that gave us this absolute God that is, in the opinion of, I think, all Mormons, not really God. And so I think that we have to take reason, revelation, and the task of the theologian is to balance these opposites. Basically, that's what I'd like to say. Thank you.
It isn't surprising to me that Paul is worried about legalism. As a lawyer, he ought to be. And I'm worried about legalism, too. I agree with him that there are a lot of Mormons who would like to do religion by the numbers, who would like to have somebody tell them exactly, day by day, what it is that they ought to be doing and simply go down the list. And I agree entirely with him that that's inadequate. As I've listened to the comments today, I'm thinking of St. Augustine. I think that Paul has been somewhat unkind and unfair to Pelagius, who simply argued for freedom and for salvation by merit rather than salvation by grace. St. Augustine, on the other hand, argued for freedom. He said, "We are free. However, everybody can be put into three categories. There is the category of those posse pecare, those who can sin. It's possible for them to sin. Unfortunately, those people cannot not sin, ever. They must sin, and they are damned. They are among the people who are damned. The second category posse non pecare, it is possible not to sin, and it might be possible for them to go either way. The third category was non posse pecare, is not possible to sin, and those people, even if they want to, cannot sin, and all of that is determined by the grace of God. They are the saints, and they will be saved no matter what. Now, in all of this, St. Augustine says all of these people have freedom, even those in the first and the third categories. I can't make any concept of freedom out of St. Augustine's remarks for those people. Janus and Paul want to have freedom, but Janus talks about the intelligence coming from a primal intelligence. A little bit of that gets chipped off for man. Well, that runs, it's sympathetic with the idea that God is an ex nihilo God that has made everything out of nothing.
Wait a second. I never espoused that idea.
You're stating all kinds of things that we don't believe in. I don't like Augustine any more than you do, and I don't believe this last thing.
No, I didn't espouse that idea. I suggested that as a possible interpretation.
Gee, I just looked at my notes. Primal intelligence may be an undifferentiated mass.
No,
that's
a possible idea.
Yeah.
I said that Kendall gets upset about that idea, but I don't because he thinks that...
I do also, as a matter of fact.
Because man is not innately good...
As soon as you say
that
man's freedom is given to him by Christ, you're in trouble. Then there is no freedom. Then there is no freedom. The strength of the Mormon freedom position derives from arguing that man is not created by anybody. That is, Joseph Smith said in the King Follett Discourse, man is as eternal as God and is co-eternal, in fact, with God. Now, whatever characteristics that primal intelligence have, those characteristics are in that as an individual. They are not created by God. They are not given to him by God. His freedom doesn't derive from God. As soon as you start giving man his freedom, in any sense, in any serious sense, the whole concept of freedom is in trouble.
Thank you.
This is the end of this cassette.